uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania, beaming down from outer space on the Sirius satellite radio system, streaming around the planet on radiopower.org, Live 365's American FM, WhiteRoseSociety.org, where you can also find the program podcast, and on cable systems in 29 states on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. So glad to have you here. We're coming up on now, it seems like a couple of years since George W. Bush and his administration, or somebody, some senior administration official in the Bush administration, brought down an ongoing CIA anti-terrorism operation in an act of treason by outing the wife of Ambassador Joe Wilson, Valerie Plame, when George W. Bush had the audacity to say...
And I don't know if we're going to find out the senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
You don't have any idea. Well, I'm curious what Ambassador Joe Wilson has to say about that these days. Ambassador Wilson, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Nice to be with you. How are you, Dave?
Great. It is so great to have you back here on the program. You have a new book out, The Politics of Truth. Your website, www.politicsoftruth.com. And just for our listeners who may not be quite so familiar with you, you're a career U.S. diplomat from 76 to 1998. During Republican and Democratic administrations, Joe Wilson served in various diplomatic posts throughout Africa and eventually as ambassador to, is it pronounced Gabon?
Gabon.
He was the acting ambassador to Baghdad when Iraq invaded Kuwait in 1990. In February 2002, investigated reports of Iraq's attempt to buy uranium from Niger, which is ultimately led to your coming into collision with the Bush administration.
That's right, yeah. And by the way, my ambassadorship to Gabon I was nominated by George Herbert Walker Bush, this president's father.
Yeah, and the guy who said that outing a CIA agent is an act of treason.
That's right, the most despicable act of treason.
Yes, the most despicable. Now, some years ago, you were in a public state, in a public forum, and you made the comment that, hang on just a second here, I pushed the wrong button. You made the comment that...
At the end of the day, it's of keen interest to me to see whether or not we can get Karl Rove frog marched out of the White House in handcuffs.
And I'm just curious if you're still of that sentiment.
Well, I would certainly like to see him frog marched out of the White House, whether it's in handcuffs or not. Whether or not he was in on the leak or the conspiracy to do what they call a workup on me is one thing. It is irrefutable, however, that after Bob Novak printed his article, and Bob Novak, by the way, is close to Karl Rove. Karl Rove was fired from George Herbert Walker Bush's earlier campaign for having leaked to Novak. After the Novak article appeared, Rove called Chris Matthews and said to him, Wilson's wife is fair game, as if my wife were some animal in hunting season. Did we really want our senior public officials to be carrying out these acts of political revenge on the public payroll? I think not. I think it's an ethical lapse it's a firing offense.
Well, the Bush administration would say that the election results indicate that we do, in fact, want that.
Well, and they might be right on that, although it's pretty clear that the public is pretty disenchanted and is increasingly of the view that they have been lied to by the Bush administration.
Yeah, which brings us to the Downing Street memos and the Downing Street minutes. What I believe represent the greatest potential to leave the Bush presidency in a state of permanent disgrace. If Bush lied to gain and keep political power, doesn't precedent suggest, the precedent of Nixon and Clinton most recently, suggest that he and his collaborators in the administration may be vulnerable to impeachment? How's that for a loaded question?
Well, I think realistically, so long as the Republicans hold both houses of Congress, impeachment is really not an option. They're just not going to do it. In fact, one of the things that came out in the Conyers hearing the other day, which was held in the basement of the Capitol because the Republicans who in the majority own all the real estate up there would not give them a room in which to have the hearings. Not a single Republican showed up for these Downing Street memo hearings. And indeed, they called 11 votes so as to try and disrupt the proceedings as they went forward, indicating to me that the Republicans who are in charge in both the House and the Senate have really put their partisan tendencies above their constitutional responsibilities and indeed above the national security of the United States.
It indicates to me that there's something really big here that they're trying to cover up. I mean, why would they go to all that effort?
Well, they've been trying to cover up the administration's machinations from the very beginning. If you take a look at the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence report, and by the way, in the paperback version of my book, which is just out, Russ Hoyle writes extensively on that. An independent journalist took a look at some of the things that have happened. It's distinctly a cover-up. And indeed, Senator Roberts promised that they would have a second inquiry into the political use of intelligence after the election, and he has since said that that's on the back burner.
Ambassador Joseph Wilson, your book is titled The Politics of Truth. What are the politics of truth?
Well, the title of the book is really just an indication of what this administration has done in order to keep the truth from being known. And my thesis in all of this is that the American people have a right and indeed need in a democracy to be able to debate issues of war and peace based on facts, not just on information, which is put into the public square because it happens to support a political decision that's already been made. And in this case, these people misstate the facts and lie even when they don't have to, just to stay in practice. And as a consequence of this, we now have, 1,725 Americans dead, tens of thousands of Americans injured, who knows how many thousands of Iraqis killed, injured, and displaced, $300 billion spent, and our international reputation in an absolute tatters.
I'm wondering what the status is of the investigation into your wife's outing. And why is it that that we have a reporter from Time magazine and a reporter from the New York Times who are both facing jail time, and Bob Novak still running around loose?
Well, with respect to the status of the investigation, I'd love to know as well. I sense that the Pat Fitzgerald, the special counsel, is waiting for the Supreme Court to act on the appeal that Cooper and Judy Miller have made to the Supreme Court, that they have the right to protect their source under the First Amendment. Why not Novak? There are a couple of different theories. One is that Novak has already talked to the special counsel and given him everything he wants.
Well, if that's the case, then why can't they just proceed with the prosecution?
Well, I think that's something that's better asked to him because I don't know. The crime that was committed was a crime against the country, not against me, and he doesn't keep me informed of what he's doing, obviously.
Yeah.
He apparently thinks that he needs their testimony in order to substantiate charges he's prepared to bring against some of the individuals. It also strikes me, although this is speculation having looked at his record, that he is a prosecutor who ties his case up nicely in a bow before he indicts. He does not indict on the way up to the top. He indicts everybody at once. That's certainly what happened in Illinois when he indicted 56 members of the Republican Party and when he indicted the Chicago mob families just recently.
Interesting. So you think that there's some possibility that this ongoing cover-up will get busted open?
Oh, I think so. I think there are any number of investigations that are going on. They may or may not be linked, but they all seem to involve many of the same players, and I think eventually one of these things will break forth onto the public stage.
What's your opinion of what happened and with the invasion of Iraq and now the occupation? I do a local program here in the Northwest in KPOJ in Portland, Oregon,
mm-hmm.
Before I do this national program. And we had on this morning, coming to Portland this weekend, or this week, tomorrow in fact, are a couple of guys from the Iraqi trade union movement, which is illegal. Paul Bremer continued Saddam Hussein's law, which said that private unions in the private sector were against the law, and or in the public sector, actually in both sectors, I think, ultimately. And this guy is talking about how they're trying to get, you know, trade unions going in Iraq, and he said that, you know, what's going to bring it about is when the occupiers leave. And he was very clear that what it was all about was that there was an occupation going on, that would be us.
Right.
I'm wondering, what's your take on what happened in Iraq, you know, the invasion, the occupation, why it might have happened, and where do we go from here?
Well, let me just say that when I entered the debate on what we should do in Iraq, I brought my own experience in Iraq to the public square. And the argument that I made was that the threat from Saddam's weapons of mass destruction programs may or may not be real. we had to take them seriously, and it was important to resuscitate the international political will to do something about it. That did not translate into invasion, conquest, and occupation as a strategy or as an approach, in my judgment. I laid that out in several articles I wrote. I always thought that it was the highest risk, lowest reward option in our foreign policy arsenal. We undertook it, and indeed, the notion that it was going to be a cakewalk and that we were going to be greeted as liberators, put forward by Cheney and some of his acolytes, was demonstrably false within several days of having arrived in Baghdad. And now here we are. We're seen as occupiers. We've leveled the city of Fallujah. We're killing Iraqis right and left. And for every Iraqi we kill, there are Muslims around the world who are hating us more and more. And people who would be well advised to view what's going on in Iraq, not from through the prism of the American media, but through the prism of some of the foreign media, and particularly the Arab media, understand your enemy. And we have created millions and millions and millions of potential enemies, of whom several hundred thousand, I think, or tens of thousands anyway, will be tempted to do us serious damage in such things as terrorist attacks. What do we do now? I don't have an answer. As I said in my testimony the other day, I do think it is time for us to begin to ask the question as to whether or not our continued presence in Iraq is part of the problem rather than part of the solution. Now, with respect to trade unions, let me sort of state the obvious. I have a pro-trade union bias, having been a member of the Brotherhood of Carpenters and Joiners for 5 years in the Northwest, in Washington State, as well as in California. I think raising labor living standards has benefited this country enormously and has benefited other countries enormously, and in fact is part of the great democratic tradition of rewarding hard work with pay and benefits.
Mm-hmm.
And why we did this to the Iraqis, why we denied them the right to create their own trade unions is anybody's guess. I think it was one of the many, many mistakes that was made by the Coalition Provisional Authority.
Do you think we have about 30 seconds here? Do you think that it was a mistake, or do you think that this was part of the neocon, belief structure, and they just thought that they could create a paradise by doing?
No, I think it was part of their belief structure. Yeah.
So this was ideological.
Cheap labor, no taxes, will create out of Iraq everything that that has been demonstrably proven to be demonstrably false everywhere else that it's been tried, but we'll try it in Iraq because we will own everything that there is owned there.
Yeah, okay. Ambassador Joe Wilson, his new book, it's out in paperback now, The Politics of Truth, highly recommended. Politicsoftruth.com for more information on the Internet. Joseph Wilson, Ambassador Joseph Wilson, thanks so much for being with us today.
Great to be with you. Thanks, Tom.
I do appreciate it. Keep up the great work, sir. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
We say we build democracy, but really build refineries and drill for our prosperity from oil in the ground.
Yes, oil in the ground. Welcome back, my friends. 25 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Yes, oil in the ground. Always something important, always something to worry about, always something to be considered about.
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Well, in the entire planet, second only to Saudi Arabia. I mean, it's important that we remember this. If you don't believe it, just ask Dick Cheney. Jeremy in State College, Pennsylvania on the line. By the way, if you want to call into the program, our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. If you'd like to drop into our live chat room, go to TomHartman.com and click live chat. It will take you right there. Hey, Jeremy.
Hi, Tom. My computer's in the fritz, and that's the only way I can listen to you, so I haven't been able to listen to you in a while, but I'm calling about the PBS funding cuts, because as you know, I'm the PBS guy that calls you every now and again.
Uh-huh.
I talked to one of the staffers of my congressman at length about it yesterday, and the killer about it is they really just don't understand how important this money is to PBS. I went through the
I think they understand perfectly well how important it is to PBS. Or did you talk to a Democrat?
No, I talked to Republican.
And yeah, they understand how important it is.
Well, the attitude they took was, here's the specifics. It's part of the labor and education appropriations bill. It's supposed to be voted on Thursday. And the line-by-line items, it says PBS got $387 million last year, and that'll go down to $300 million this year. So it's an $87 million cut.
And this is, by the way, less money than we spend in one day in Iraq.
Right.
And we're talking about the entire annual budget for the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Right. And the Ready to Learn grants that fund all the funding for Sesame Street and the kids programs, that gets about, I would say, $4 or $5 million, I forget exactly, but that gets eliminated entirely.
Right.
And when I said, well, that's a 45% cut, and they want to end it all within 3 years, all funding for CTB and everything gone. He said, well, it's kind of a red herring because it's not 45% for CTB, it's only 22%. I'm like, yeah, but you add that up with all the other grants that go into the PBS pie, and that is 45%. So they kind of, he tiptoed around, danced, hem and haw, whatever. And then he tried to say, well, you're, you know, because the congressman I spoke to, Lovell Saffer, he's been on WPSX on local affairs programs about public issues quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And he's done, you know, spots for us, you know, like, you know, support PBS, blah, blah, blah. And yet he would not commit to our management in a phone conference call to, you know, vote for an amendment one way or the other to keep funding where it is.
Yeah. Now, these guys, they have a clear agenda to destroy public broadcasting. And the reason why is because they want to make sure that there is no media in the United States that is not under either A, under corporate control, or B, has the potential to be under corporate control. They could be threatened. I mean, even progressive talk radio at some point, theoretically, could be threatened by the loss of advertisers. How long would it last if all of the advertisers got together and said, that's it, no more?
Right, you know? And the other scary part is, there is no educational kids programming on television anywhere anymore except on PBS.
Right.
And shows like Sesame Street and Arthur that have good, viable character identification could survive, but they would move to commercial television. And I think part of it also is they'd like to have that marketplace where they could say, okay, well, Big Bird's a brand. Let's use them to sell stuff to
kids.
That's
right. You've got a whole bunch of very large corporations who are major donors to the Republican Party and to the Democrats. I mean, let's be truthful about this. The Democrats are chowing down at this trough, not quite to the extent of the Republicans, but we have a political system increasingly, particularly since the Buckley Supreme Court decision and the First National Bank versus Boston versus Bilotti Supreme Court decision. We have a political system that increasingly requires them to, kind of forces them into a position of having to pay attention to this. So you got these big corporations that would just love to advertise to kids on Sesame Street. And so if Sesame Street's on CBS instead of PBS, then they think that's just wonderful because then they can sell, you know, candy bars and sugary cereal to them. So, you know, that's the bottom line from their point of view. Jeremy, thanks for raising the issue. It is an important issue, and I appreciate your calling in. And I know MoveOn.org has this, you know, let's get 1 million signatures on a petition right now thing that they're doing. And, you know, I tip my hat to them. It's difficult times for public broadcasting, and those folks who are believers in it, I'm among them. I'm a supporter of public broadcasting. Need to, you know, speak out and be heard. We do need a national voice. We need a BBC here. 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Truth in Broadcasting. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix. Increasingly the blue pill, I'd say, these days. Welcome back to our program. Our toll-free number, 1-866-889-8894. TomHartman.com, the website. The Guardian reporting today, one of the four major newspapers in the United Kingdom. The Guardian reporting that the Foreign Office, the British Foreign Office, this their equivalent of the State Department, knew before Tony Blair joined us in going to war to invading Iraq, knew that there was that the weapons of mass destruction claim was nonsense. Karn Ross, A member of the British mission to the United Nations in New York during the run-up to the invasion resigned from the Foreign Office last year after giving evidence to the Butler inquiry. He thought about publishing his testimony because he felt so angry, but he was warned that if he did, he might be prosecuted under the Official Secrets Act. Nonetheless, he has now come out. He told the Guardian, quote, "I'd read the intelligence on WMD for 4.5 years, and there's no way that it could sustain the case that the government was presenting. All of my colleagues knew that as well." End of quote. So the lead sentence in the Guardian's article today, a key Foreign Office diplomat responsible for liaising with UN inspectors said today that claims the government made about Iraq's weapons program were, quote, totally implausible. And that is as in not plausible, as in not possible, as in they made this stuff up, as in it's crazy. Are you kidding? Can you believe this? Yeah. Speaking of which, in the crazy, can you believe this? Dick Durbin has apologized for this, which I think was a horrible mistake to make the apology. And yet you got to acknowledge the fact that when Republicans make parallels like Tom DeLay saying that the EPA is a Gestapo organization, nobody bothers with them. It doesn't get reported in the media. Chris Matthews isn't getting hysterical about it every day. But when Democrats say things that might compare the behavior of Republicans or the United States in some way, our policies, to Nazis or Germany or something like that, then, of course, the media goes hysterical. And Dick Durbin, of course, is a Democrat. Democrat from Illinois. And so here's what he said on the floor on the floor of Congress. He said, "When you read some of the graphic descriptions of what has occurred here, I almost hesitate to put them in the record, and yet they have to be added to this debate. Let me read you what one FBI agent saw," and I quote from his report. And then Durbin quotes, "On a couple of occasions, I entered interview rooms to find a detainee chained hand and foot in a fetal position to the floor, with no chair, no food or water. Most times they urinated or defecated on themselves, and they'd been left there for 18 to 24 hours or more. On one occasion, the air conditioning had been turned down so far, and the temperature was so cold in the room that the barefooted detainee was shaking with cold. On another occasion, the air conditioner had been turned off, making the temperature in the unventilated room well over 100 degrees. The detainee was almost unconscious on the floor with a pile of hair next to him. He had apparently been literally pulling his hair out throughout the night. On another occasion, not only was the temperature unbearably hot, but extremely loud rap music was being played in the room, and had been since the day before, with a detainee chained hand and foot in the fetal position on a tile floor." And then Dick Durbin, after having read that quote from the FBI, says, "If I read this to you and did not tell you that it was an FBI agent describing what Americans had done to prisoners in their control, you would most certainly believe this must have been done by Nazis, Soviets in their gulags, or some mad regime, Pol Pot or others, that had no concern for human rights. Sadly, this is not the case. This is the action of Americans in the treatment of their prisoners." End of quote from Dick Durbin. This is what Dick Durbin said that got the right so hysterical. And so now they're trying to turn this into, oh, it's no big deal. Let's just make jokes about it and cause the Americans to think that, you know, it's no big deal that we're engaging in behavior that no civilized nation in the world has ever done or would do or would sustain.
Anything better than diet, Korans, prayer rugs? I mean, where else can Muslims go in the world to find everything they need?
Right, Club Gitmo.
There's no better place than Gitmo. Club Gitmo, the Muslim resort.
Yeah, let's make fun of it. Let's try to make it humorous. Yes, it's just a great place. It's the wonderful place for the Muslims to go. Yeah. Yeah, right. This kind of mentality and this kind of obfuscation, this attempt by the Reich to convince Americans that anything goes, that we're not part of these civilized nations, that if our enemy is terrible, that we need to be terrible too, that it's a new kind of war, is anti-American. These people, Limbaugh, when he does this, he is spitting in the face of George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, John Adams, Sam Adams. He's spitting in their faces. He's spitting on their graves. This is horrible. World War II was a new kind of war, too. 50 million people died in World War II. We never resorted to these kind of tactics. And because we never resorted to these kind of tactics, after World War II was done, the people of Germany and the people of Japan, when we occupied those countries, guess how many soldiers we lost in that occupation? None. Not one single American soldier died in the occupation of Germany or Japan. My father was there in the occupation of Japan. And you can read Ted Sorensen's report, or Theodore White's, excuse me, his report on his occupation, on the occupation of Germany. It's published in the early 50s. I think it was called Witness to History. This is no secret. Not one American died in hostile fire in the occupation of Germany or Japan after World War II. Why? Because we didn't engage in barbaric behavior with their prisoners of war. And so when we were occupying their countries and helping them put their countries back together, they didn't perceive us as the oppressive occupiers, as the torturers. They perceived us as, you know, we saved you from a madman and now we're here to help. George Bush has fought a very different way than Dwight Eisenhower did or General Patton did. And against the advice of his best soldiers, the soldiers who opposed him, who disagreed with him, they're toast. They're gone. They're out. No more. And George Bush has turned the United States into a pariah, an international pariah, to where a United States senator can legitimately say, you know, if I heard about this behavior, not knowing where it was coming from, I would have thought that it was the Nazis or the Soviets or Pol Pot. Because you would have. This is the kind of thing the Nazis and the Soviets and Pol Pot did. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number, George in Coos Bay, Oregon on the line. Hey, George, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Sure sounds like Gitmo is the kind of place that Rush wanted affluent white narcotics addicts to go to.
Yeah, maybe one should.
But I digress. What I wanted to talk to you about is something I heard about on Democracy Now! Today. It is a Southern California Republican representative, a congressman on the House of Defense Appropriations Committee, sells his house for $1.7 million
to a defense contractor.
Defense contractor. Yeah. He turns around and sells it for what it's really worth, for $1 million, and thereby gives the guy a semi-legal $700,000 bribe. And guess what? All of that new business is coming to that little minor defense contractor all of a sudden.
Right. Yeah. This bribery story actually broke in the mainstream media, oddly enough, about three days ago. I better sit down.
I'm in shock.
No, this story's been floating around for a couple of days, and I'm glad to see that that Amy Goodman did an in-depth piece on it, because it really is a horrific story. What's really horrific about it, though, is not, you know, what happened in California with this guy. I don't have the story right in front of me. I don't recall his name. That's not the horrible story. The horrible story is that nobody's taking it seriously as a horrible story in the mainstream media.
Well, it's a bribe.
Crime against America. What Michael Jackson did was not necessarily, you know, is a crime against some kids if he did it. But this is a crime against America. Where is the hysteria? I mean, this, you know, some guy kills his wife. What was his name? I've even forgot now. That's how memorable this stuff
Scott
is.
Scott Peterson.
Scott Peterson. He kills his wife. That's a national story for weeks. This should be a national story. This should be a big deal.
Not even subtle.
They're not even
trying to be coy about it.
Yeah.
You know, you give me $700,000 more than my house is worth, and I'll run millions of dollars worth of defense contracts your way. Yeah. Thank you very much for listening to me, Tom.
Thanks a lot, George. I appreciate the call. Good to hear from
you.
1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Jeff in Atlanta on the line. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, my uncle, I'm a Vietnam veteran, but my uncle's World War II veteran. When the Japanese surrendered, we occupied their island. My uncle said the Japanese hated us, and we lost 20,000 men after the war.
Where?
In Japan, in the Far East. I mean, we.
I got to say, Jeff, you're wrong.
I mean, and looking at war crimes, like my uncle told me that the general that ran the air raids on Japan.
Yeah.
Here, the general tell a young Robert McNamara, told him, we have to win this war, otherwise going to be tried as war criminals. Because they, like he said, one night, they burned to death 100,000 civilians.
Yeah, it was
in one night.
I know, it was called Hiroshima. And there were real concerns about that. But, Jeff, I'm sorry, you're wrong. The occupation of Japan and Germany was relatively peaceful, largely peaceful. And it lasted for years and years. And the reason why it was peaceful was because both those countries realized that they had gone insane. And because during the war, we did not see... These are the talking points of the right wing. Oh, let's change the subject away from are we torturing people the way the Soviets do in gulags or the way the Nazis did into how many people wanted to shoot back at us in Japan? Well, I'm telling you, none of them. None of them. Robert in Asheville, North Carolina on the line. Hey, Robert, what's up?
Hi there. Robert, you're on.
Oh, Robert?
Yeah, Robert, you're live.
Yes, how you doing?
Good.
Yes, I'm calling about a gentleman that called a while ago comparing occupied Germany with occupied Japan with the war in Iraq.
Yeah.
There's absolutely no comparison. Japan had 2 nuclear bombs dropped on it. They were pretty well brought to their hands and knees. They were starving to death. They had nothing else left. And then Germany had occupied...
Okay, now hang on just a second. Hang on just a second, Robert. Iraq was losing hundreds of thousands of its own children to starvation and diarrheal diseases every year as a consequence of 9 years of sanctions. Iraq had its Air Force bombed to smithereens. Are you saying that Iraq wasn't enfeebled by us?
Okay, I'll tell you.
Okay.
They're being occupied. I was in Vietnam. The reason we went to Vietnam War is because the enemy occupied Hanoi in North Vietnam. They supplied their troops to Cambodia and Laos, and we were fighting a losing battle over there. Amongst the protesters over here raising hell that was using it against us, and I was in a firefight one time in Vietnam, and it was a terrible firefight. The next morning, went up there and I checked the enemy troops for information, their weapons, and so forth. Communist cavalry left propaganda laying around on the rice paddy. I picked up one. They said, hey, D.I., we know we won't beat you on a battlefield, but we will beat you in Washington, San Francisco, and New York.
Yeah.
And guess what? It was an American over here flying one of their friggin' flags in a protest movement.
There you go. There you go. Yeah. Robert, tell me why we were in Vietnam.
Why were we in Vietnam? Because the mindset back in those days was during the Cold War, okay?
Right.
The communists was occupying. They were going into Africa. They were going into Southeast Asia.
Okay, so in summary, you're saying the reason we were in Vietnam was because we had to stop communism, right?
That communism.
Okay, then why is it that right now George Bush wants Walmart to get even more tax breaks to put more jobs in communist China?
Hey, listen. Now you're talking about corporate, okay? That's a whole different...
I'm talking about George Bush. Okay. Why is it that George Bush announced this morning that he's going to communist Vietnam as a friend? Why did George Bush announce that this morning?
I'm sure Bill Clinton, when he told the secret...
We're not talking about Bill Clinton. We're talking about George W. Bush. Okay, Robert, thanks a lot for the call. I got it. I got what, you know, you're not going to... Matt in Wichita, Kansas. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hi, Tom. If George W. Bush is being honest and... his idea is to spread democracy throughout the world, would he not be well served to go to our allies and say, hey, look, we blew it on the WMD. We were wrong. We need help. Please come and help us out. Let's make this a multinational effort. That way the Iraqi people would see that he is not trying to occupy them long term, and maybe some good could come out of this.
Yeah, it would, but that's not what he's going to do.
Because
we're building 17, 18 massive military bases there. We've allocated more money to build an embassy there, almost $1 billion, more money than it's going to cost to rebuild the World Trade Center. I mean, you know, no, George Bush is not going to do that. He's not going to.
Well, and that was kind of my point.
And
Tom,
see, if he said that, by the way, then that would start unraveling the lie, because the whole point is that we invaded Iraq and we are occupying Iraq so that the Republicans could take the Senate in 2002, and so that Bush and the rest of the Republicans could hold the White House and the House and the Senate in 2004. Pure and
well,
simple.
My whole idea was kind of a left-handed way of making my point.
Well,
so Yeah. Okay. Thank you, Tom.
That's it.
But wouldn't that be a good idea if that was really our goal?
Well, of course, but it wasn't our goal. Yeah. Good point, Matt. And I appreciate your being facetious about it. I got it. Mike in West Burlington, Iowa. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yesterday I called the Social Security Administration to do a change of address. And while I was in a hold mode waiting for someone to talk to, they play three or four different little sound clips. And I'm going to paraphrase right now, but the sound clip said 76 million strong baby boom generation is about ready to retire, and that changes need to be made in Social Security.
Oh, in other words, you were hearing propaganda on hold.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
That's not all. It said experts agree that unless we do something, that they won't have funds. Now,
right.
If he would have added that, the reason for this is that George Bush has put us in an immoral and unjust war.
Then it would be true. Then it would absolutely be true. Mike, we're out of time, but you're absolutely right. Thanks so much for sharing that with us. Good grief. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Here's the story of a corporation that has newspapers in every place you go. It also owns a couple cable stations, a movie studio.
Uh-oh, I know where this one's going.
And there was another corporation that controlled all
Oh, yeah, and it's called the AOL Time Warner merger. Welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman with you, 1-866-889-8894. Just a reminder, on Friday of this week, I'll be at the Celebration Cinema, where WTKG in Grand Rapids, Michigan, has a studio. I will be broadcasting live from that studio. It'll be a lot of fun. Come down and join us for the program, noon to 3 Eastern time in the Celebration Cinema. In Grand Rapids, Michigan. Speaking of Michigan, Scott in Flint, Michigan on the line. Hey, Scott, what's up?
Not a lot. I just wanted to comment on the whole Guantanamo Bay thing and
sure.
Durbin's comments. Personally, I think his comments are ill-served and reprehensible. You cannot, regardless of how you view our behavior, you cannot compare the torture and mass murder of millions and millions of people to this policy.
Durbin was comparing the interrogation techniques of those regimes to the interrogation techniques that we're using. That was the comparison he was making. Are you telling me that that's not a valid comparison?
Absolutely not, because let me explain something. Also, in doing so, he completely, just on the surface, was foolish. He alienated every moderate individual in the world. He would have been far better off saying, listen, this happened right here under an American watch. We're supposed to be better than that.
Yeah.
But instead of doing that, he chose to take every Tom, Dick, and Harry in America, Joe Sixpack, myself included, and basically say, hey, look, you guys are allowing this. You guys are just as bad as Nazis and Pol Pot and everything else.
But we are allowing it, Scott.
You cannot compare.
We are allowing behavior that if you read that account, you would not think that that was done by Americans. You would think that that was done by somebody like the Nazis or Pol Pot. Would you not?
I would not think that that was done
if
by
somebody. If you
Nazis
read an account,
Pol Pot, no.
No.
Really?
Who would you think it was done by?
What's that?
Who would you think it was done by?
I would have thought that it was done by, like, the Israelis or somebody who is mistreating.
Oh, they're the bad guys.
Not by some
Scott, you're digging the same hole that Dick Durbin did. Scott, you know, your point is well taken. I don't entirely disagree with you. I'm just saying, you know, he said it. He should have stood behind it. That's my point. But I appreciate your calling, Scott. Thanks a lot. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. The place where smart people get their news and argue about it. Discuss it. Go on and on. And we'll continue for the next 2 hours.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. We'll be right back. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. It's Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894. Telephone number, TomHartman.com. The website, broadcasting live on radio stations from California to Pennsylvania and on Sirius satellite systems streaming around the world on the Internet. Welcome back to our program. So happy to be with you. It is a good time, I think, a really important time, actually, and take a breath of fresh air. And a breath of fresh air, you know, why fresh air? Well, fresh air is made mostly by trees, it turns out. And therefore, perfectly good time to be talking about what's going on with trees. In fact, our Bioneers moment here. Andy Lipkus is with the tree people. This is an absolutely fascinating story. He's the founder and president of Tree People, a guiding light for the citizen forestry movement, and TREES, Trans-Agency Resources for Environmental and Economic Sustainability, a public-private partnership aimed at making Los Angeles a sustainable urban ecosystem. We're going to have to ask him, you know, hey, what? Is that possible? Andy co-authored The Simple Act of Planting a Tree and an urban forestry video series, co-founded the Citizen Forestry Support System, serves on many boards, including the Los Angeles Conservation Corps and the Los Angeles Community Forest Advisory Council. Andy, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Great to be here.
Glad to have you with us. Now, you read all these kind of end-of-days scenarios, particularly those that have to do with the end of peak oil, and which we seem to be right on top of now. We're fighting wars around the world where oil just happens to be, and ginning up other wars like in Venezuela and Iran where more oil happens to be. And you read these scenarios about, you know, no oil and people starving and there's no transportation of food and cities will be death traps and things like that. How in that, you know, in the context of the world that we are creating, how could you suggest that Los Angeles could become a sustainable urban ecosystem?
Well, I think confronting the issues that you're talking about, and let's add water to it, which is going to be a global crisis even worse than oil and energy.
Already is in most of the world. Oil is for the first world, water is for the third world.
And it's fast approaching the first world.
Yeah.
And so given that scenario, we better actually set our sights on how do we become sustainable and survivable. And so in one sense, we're just doing survival thinking. The good news is that much of our challenge is created by the fact that we are wasting most of the natural energy, natural resources that we have here. And in so doing, we're costing businesses, we're costing health, we're costing the environment. When we begin to actually understand our cities as natural ecosystems, the natural ecosystem that was here, and begin to build systems, infrastructure systems around them that utilize the natural resources.
Well, that sounds nice rhetorically, Andy, but exactly what are you talking about? What do people do?
Well, we're actually literally talking about retrofitting cities to capture solar energy, capture the water. In Los Angeles, it's a great example. You're right, we are a poster child for unsustainability. The amount of energy and pollution the energy that we use, pollution we generate, and CO2 we generate makes us probably the largest urban source of CO2 on the planet. And so our behavior is a real challenge. What we did was actually start looking at how much waste there is and how much energy and water is available. Amazing facts come out. Los Angeles receives half the water it needs in rainfall every year, but it throws almost all of it away, creating floods, pollution.
Letting it run off in storm drains, you're talking about.
Yeah, all because the city was built as if it was on a slab of concrete. Law requires all the rainfall to be thrown away as urban runoff.
So what's the solution? That everybody put gutters on their roofs and put a big cistern, a rain barrel there?
You got it. We actually looked around the world at societies old and current that have been harvesting rainfall. we devised a way that Los Angeles could reduce its water importation by half. Using nature as a model, trees actually do capture water, get it back in the ground, clean it, and all of that.
And then and recycle it back into the air very effectively as well.
They recycle it in the air. They recharge the aquifer.
Right.
But the way we've designed our systems is right now we haven't valued it. We've thrown it away. And so we began the Trees Project, brought a bunch of different agencies together that, after 12 years of research, showed that not only is it technically and economically feasible to retrofit cities, but that the money that we're going to spend on Band-Aids, improving, fixing our stormwater system, fixing our sewage system, fixing our broken flood control system, by bringing those agencies and having them work together, there's enough money currently in the plan to actually save money and retrofit the city so we capture all that rainfall, shade home structures, shade the city, break up the urban heat island, and lower the amount of energy that we need to use for cooling.
What role would trees play in this?
Well, trees actually play a huge role. In the most simple way, school kids talk about the fact that trees produce fresh air, they produce shade and cooling. But if you actually understand all the things a tree does, we tell kids they're multitasking superheroes, and they truly are. As a flood control device, as a water clarifier, water recharge machine, most people don't see trees as that, and they really are. We have oaks all over this country, and a native California oak, an old one that might be 100 feet in diameter, the root system and the leaves and the mulch and everything right on top of the roots, on the ground, all that together forms a huge tank, also 100 feet in diameter, tank-like sponge formed by the mulch and the leaves. Well, we had the U.S. Forest Service Research Labs calculate how much water that one tree could process. Turns out it can handle 57,000 gallons in a 10-inch rainstorm event. It grabs the water, cleans it, and puts it into the aquifer. You take that one tree out, and you're dumping in a big flash flood. You're dumping 57,000 gallons of water into a city, into an area, creating flooding, creating pollution, and robbing that water from the local water supply.
And the tree puts that water into the aquifer by the surface roots drawing water actually down below into the lower layers of the water, into the lower layers of the earth. Is that
actually what happens is you've got your roots holding the soil, but the root zone is this highly conditioned area like a sponge. So it's really porous. It's habitat for things that drill holes, from worms to snakes to rodents to microorganisms. And so what you have is a treatment system because that kind of soil and those kinds of organisms clean water. They are the earth's water cleaning machine. They can actually eat.
So the giant aquifers across the United States, the Ogallala, for example, comes to mind, these were the product of trees?
No, the symbiosis. The trees have always been the way that water gets into them.
Right. That's what I mean. Yeah.
Trees use surface water, but they actually, with them performing that task, yeah, they're a much bigger source of contributing to the recharge.
Like an injection system. They're exactly. They're these little, yeah, okay. And you take the trees out, and then you have just a tarp over the top, or like concrete over the top of it, and essentially, even if it's soil, you still have runoff.
Exactly. And why are we seeing increased flooding on the Mississippi, throughout Europe, all over this country?
Because of deforestation.
Exactly. And paving and urbanization and sprawl.
Because
in every case, you take out a tree and you're dumping thousands of gallons of water and creating that problem. And the problem is that is the tree is this natural green infrastructure.
Yeah.
Performing these services for free.
Yeah.
We take them out, and we're not charging developers when we take them out. We're not saying, oh, you got to replace 57,000 gallons.
So the trees are not competing with us for water. They're actually helping us save the water. What about the energy? If you're going to convert Los Angeles to being dependent upon solar energy, for example, rather than fossil fuels, you're going to put solar collectors on the roof of all the houses. But if you have enough trees, they're competing for the sun, are they not?
They are. And what you do is we've we've learned that community forestry, urban forestry, to do this right, the tree planting is more an act of acupuncture. It's putting the right tree in the right place. So you plant the trees so they do the best job they can as watershed
right.
devices, and so they also are doing the best job they can shading, cooling, and also allowing solar energy to be produced.
Would this involve changing the whole mindset that people have about lawns that came out of, you know, 16th century England, where the really and truly wealthy didn't have to worry about growing food in their backyard, and so they planted grass as a way of demonstrating their wealth, and then, you know, in 19th century America, we started imitating that as a way of the middle class saying, see, we're like the British aristocracy?
Yeah, we inherited a pretty unsustainable practice.
Right.
Yes.
It was flaunting unsustainability as a way of flaunting wealth, actually.
Well, exactly. And that was in a day when there was a sense of endless resources.
Right.
And now we're in a new day where we are seeing, like peak oil, we're seeing...
So instead of grass, we should be planting trees, and then whatever happens underneath them, you know, what? Or you put ivy there, or you do rock gardens, or what? How do you...
Well, there's even appropriate grasses. When you're using the right native species, grasses and other vegetation that can actually be flea-resistant and make a nice lawn, like with native yarrow, it's just as nice to look at and sit on, but it doesn't need to be watered.
Yarrow is the botanical name is Achillea millifolium, and it's got a great aromatic oil. It smells a little bit like pine.
Yep.
And a lot of insects just don't like it at all. It's also supposed to be good for your lungs. It's an herb that, you know, for people with lung diseases, make tea out of it.
Yeah, and so the point is that it's not such a radical... It is going to require some lifestyle change. The fundamental change is that we all need to understand that we are managers of the ecosystem, every one of us.
Yeah.
We've been operating in that same ignorance and arrogance as if what we do doesn't count, where the fact is everything we do counts. You know, every drop of oil you drop on your driveway winds up going not away... It actually goes into the street, goes into the gutter, goes into the storm drain, and ultimately makes it out to down the river, and either into a lake or a bay or the ocean. And it doesn't stop there. It winds up going to somebody else's community. And so,
yeah, or going into some fish that ends up on your plate, and then
exactly.
you're wondering, hey, how did these toxins get in this fish? Andy Lipkus, he's the founder of Tree People, www.treepeople.org. Check it out. Great website. Andy, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's great to be with you.
And keep up the good work. You're doing, it's a fine thing that you're doing. Andy Lipkus, www.treepeople.org. T-R-E-E, people. Yes. Easily spelled .org. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman program.
And there won't be now. Freedom from the oppression of those who would say the Fourth Amendment, rights of privacy, forget it. The federal government now suggesting the Department of Homeland Security sniffing around at the suggestion that ISPs should keep permanent logs on everybody's internet activity so that anytime they want, they can check it out. The First Amendment, the right of people to peaceably assemble and petition for redress of grievances. No, the Bushies are saying you show up at our meetings paid for with taxpayer dollars with a no blood for oil bumper sticker, you're toast. Welcome back. Tom Hartman with you. Ellen Ratner with us from the Talk Radio News Service. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. A couple interesting things. I'm at the White House today, and I asked Scott McClellan if they had done anything about figuring out what the impact of the $60 a barrel oil prices was going to have on the trucking industry, on individuals, on the airline industry, you know, things that make America move.
Right.
And all I heard was, well, you know, this is why we need to pay a comprehensive energy. We need a comprehensive energy package. I said, well, that's fine, but what about in the next 6 months? Well, you know, we take this very – I mean, I just got the same old – same old.
Yeah. And what's interesting is if you look back over the recessions for the last 40 years, more or less, since the early 70s or the late 60s, every, with one exception, every major recession that we've had has followed a spike in oil prices.
Well, of course.
I mean, it just makes sense. You know.
Of course, and they're doing zip about it. A couple other interesting things. Senator Lautenberg is going to bring an amendment to the floor. He has some co-sponsors, including Hillary Clinton, Dianne Feinstein, Russ Feingold. And what he wants to do is to make sure that there are companies, it would prohibit companies from doing business through offshore shell companies with countries that sponsor terrorism. Syria, Iran, et cetera. Because
so this is an anti-Halliburton bill.
Basically, that's right. He said General Electric, Halliburton, and ConocoPhillips are three of the ones that they are really targeting with this bill. And also, just because the right can never rest, Senator Tom Coburn, Dr. Coburn, remember him? He introduced today the Parents' Right to Know Act. It's going to require parents to be notified at least 5 days before a minor is issued a prescription contraceptive by a Title X clinic.
So, yeah, okay. Well, you know, the conservative argument against that, of course, is don't you want to know what your kids are up to? The answer is yes, if we were all beaver and cleaver moms and dads, that makes perfect sense. But unfortunately, that's not the world we live in. And our laws define people as adults long after they've reached reproductive age. So anyhow, you didn't need me to hear me rant
about
that.
Right, exactly. Okay, a couple other interesting things. There was a Vietnam protest today to protest the Vietnam
the ambassador from Vietnam. Prime Minister.
Prime Minister, thank you. Yeah. And I went out there and talked to these guys. And one of the things they're saying, of course, is the human rights thing. But the two other issues that they were big on is, look, we don't want them to have relations just so they can build cheap factories there. And the third thing they said is Bush is so big on sexual trafficking, but this administration in Vietnam, the prime minister, is very big on sexual trafficking. And what's also interesting, the Vietnam vets against the war, or not against the war, sorry, the Vietnam vets from the war, have been very active in with this prime minister, and they don't want to protest. They don't want to get involved in this because apparently he's been pretty good in helping them find missing veterans, et cetera.
So this protest is not a Vietnam veterans protest. This is a Vietnamese of Americans of Vietnamese origin.
That's right, exactly.
American.
Many of who came over against the war and since the war, and they say, well, you know, why are we doing business with communist countries such as
right.
China, such as Vietnam, and one of them asked me about, well, you know, he cuts off Cuba. Why isn't he cutting off Vietnam?
Yeah. Well, that's because that would be logical, Ellen.
Right.
I'm sorry. You know, Cuba is a communist dictatorship. China is a communist dictatorship. Vietnam is a communist dictatorship. Yeah, that would be logical. That's just beyond the conservatives these days. Ellen Radner with the Talk Radio News Service. Thanks so much, Ellen, for your report today. We'll talk to you tomorrow. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
Her newborn baby's wailing like a moaning dove. An old man with broken teeth stranded without love. Do I understand your question, man? Is it hopeless and forlorn? Come in, she said, I'll give you shelter from the storm.
And welcome back. Your shelter from the storm, the Tom Hartman radio program here. Welcome back to our program. It is 27 minutes before the hour. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894, tomhartman.com. Of course, the website, if you'd like to drop into the chat room, live chat room, you're welcome to. Brian in New Hampshire's on the line. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind today?
Hi, I just wanted to, I had to call in about the guy that called up talking about comparing the Japan post-war occupation to Iraq today. People are so ignorant of history in America, that's one of the biggest tools that this administration has been able to use in its policy, its foreign policy. There's a piece on the internet, a warning from history by the great Japanese, the great historian of Japan, John W. Dower of MIT, a warning from history, and he writes about that our occupation of Japan and Germany. It enjoyed virtually unquestioned legitimacy, moral as well as legal, in the eyes of not merely the victors but of all of Japan's Asian neighbors, and goes on from there. And he goes on to say that it was the last great exercise, basically, of New Deal idealism by the Roosevelt and the Truman administration. In Japan, post-war Japan, and it was occupation of Japan was a success because of 2 years or so of genuine reformist idealism. And
my father was there. I mean, you know, yeah. I can't say that I was there, but I certainly heard the stories as a kid.
But also, this gets into why is Vietnam a communist dictatorship today? At that same time, Ho Chi Minh was our ally against the Japanese invaders of Indochina, and he rescued American pilots, unlike the POWs of the later Vietnam War, like John McCain and all that. He rescued American flyers from the Japanese and brought them to safety to the American allies. He, in August 1945, just as Japan was surrendering, Ho Chi Minh and the Viet Minh forces, the Vietnamese communist forces, you could call them basically, but they were very much nationalist forces as well. They marched into Hanoi in August 1945. Ho Chi Minh read from the American Declaration of Independence. He had OSS, basically CIA officers, standing behind him saluting. And he thought America, as an anti-colonial people against the British Empire, you know, we were going to be on his side against the French, logically.
Which is the same thing, by the way, that Castro thought when he took Cuba.
Right, and as Ho read that speech to 500,000 of his followers in Hanoi, Vietnam, as he ended it, the two American P-51 Mustangs flew overhead. If you ever see that movie, it's about the Empire of the Sun, about the British kid there. He's a POW under the Japanese, mm-hmm. but he shows the Cadillac of the sky. He calls it the P-51 Mustang.
Right.
And it was a real mechanical work of art, even though it's a war machine.
An incredibly powerful engine. Yeah,
and flying over Hanoi there, two P-51 Mustangs, the Vietnamese crowd there cheered wildly. The American liberators were flying over, and we had the Vietnam question in hand. Ho Chi Minh could easily have been at least influenced to a mixed economy and capitalism over time. He was nothing like these hardliners in North Korea. And he could have.
Well, the same was true of Castro in his early days. I mean, Castro had come to the United States. He wanted to try out for the New York Yankees. Castro, when he first overthrew Batista, and Batista was reviled by his people, and we didn't participate in that overthrow, but we certainly didn't do anything to stop it because we knew that it was inevitable. Batista was going to fall. We sort of facilitated it. And Castro came to us and asked for aid. And, you know, this was after Eisenhower's heart attack, and Nixon was sort of running foreign policy at the time. And Nixon basically said, no, go take a leap.
That gave us the Bay of Pigs policy, too.
Actually, the Bay of Pigs was Nixon's October surprise. It was that was planned in 1960 as part of the campaign strategy, and they couldn't finish the thing because of a storm. But in any case, you know, Nixon said no, and he thought Castro would go away, and Castro instead went to Russia and said, well, you know, the Americans won't help me. How about you? And Russia was just all eager. But, you know, this is... There's a long line of the policy failures here, but Brian, I think it's a great point that you make, and I thank you for calling up and making it, that there is a huge difference between the American invasion and occupation of Iraq, which does not have moral legitimacy. Iraq was not threatening the United States. It was not threatening its neighbors. It did not have weapons of mass destruction, and it had nothing to do with 9/11. Might have been a loony guy, a dangerous guy, a bad guy, as you know, dangerous to his own people, as the leader of the country. You can say that of about 100 countries in the world right now. Certainly 70 or 80, you know, solidly. But you know, that's not the basis for the United States to spend $300 billion. What's going to probably be $1 trillion by the time it's all said and done. And so far, 1,725 American lives. I'm sorry, it's just not the basis for it. Never was. We were always the nation that only attacked when we were attacked first. That was always us. And the fact that, you know, our allied agreements is what got us into World War One, you know, to this day causes people to argue about World War One. I mean, I'm still not convinced that Woodrow Wilson did the right thing in getting us into World War One. I would love somebody to convince me of that, frankly. I don't know that much about the history of that particular era. I can tell you all about other points in history. That's one that I read the histories on it, and I just, you know, there's so many different ways to spin that. There's so many different ways to look at it that I get lost in them. So anyhow, the point is that historically, we've been the ones, not who start wars, but who end them. And on those occasions when we have tried to invade and occupy countries like Vietnam and like Iraq, we have had the same experience that other empires do. You know, whether it was the Roman Empire in the Middle East or whether it was the British Empire in Africa, we had the same experience, which is that, or the British Empire in India is probably the best example, is that over time, the locals say, no thanks, we want our own country. Tribalism is rooted in our genes. It comes out of the need for family. And then the need for tribe and the need for nation. This is something that's genetic. You're not going to overrule it, George W. Bush. You're not going to overrule it by fear, by threats of force, no matter how many people you kill. In fact, the more people you kill in Iraq, the more nationalistic they're going to become, the stronger they're going to become in terms of their resistance to us. It's just how it works. Look at the Boston Massacre that arguably helped trigger the American Revolution. I mean, you know, a couple of people died. And then, you know, and then the shot heard around the world. I mean, we were up to maybe 200-300 people had died by the time that an actual shooting war had broken out with the American Revolution. And in Iraq, I mean, think of all the families who have family members who've died. You know, how long are they going to put up with that? They're not. Obviously, they're not right now. And our soldiers are dying because of the failed policies of this administration. And it's a tragedy, a disaster, and ultimately a crime against America as well as against the world. Al in Houston, Texas on the line. Hey, Al, what's on your mind today?
Oh, I just wanted to tell you I went out and bought one of your books. It was the one that's kind of like a cartoon comic book.
Oh, yeah, We the People, A Call to Take Back America.
That's right, yeah. I know that you have written other books, and I had a special order that one. I always wonder if they're all in comic book format.
No, that's the only one.
Okay, well, I was then wondering if that one was particularly targeted for a younger audience.
No, it's actually that book of all my books is the only one that I didn't sit down to write as a book. The publisher came to me and they said, you know, they pointed out that I'd written a series of columns for Common Dreams about the history of America and, you know, how we got to where we are. I mean, literally starting in the very beginning. And they thought that it was a good idea to turn these. Gene, the owner of Corway Publishing, he said, you know, it would be a great idea to turn this into a comic book. And his publishing company does these kind of books. And I was skeptical. You know, I said, you know, I don't know. You know, I don't know how it would work. And he said, I think it'll make it very accessible. People will enjoy reading it. And so I said, okay, well, take a shot at it. And so they brought in an artist and they brought in an editor and they chopped up my Common Dreams pieces and they turned it into a comic book. And all the rest of my books, I actually wrote every word in them. Well, I wrote every word that's in We the People as well. But, you know, I by and large edited most of my own books. You know, I'd have, you know, somebody come in at the last minute and go through and find the mistakes or, you know, do some reorganizational work. But by and large, you know, I played the role of author. With this book, it's a series of columns. Each chapter is one of my Common Dreams columns, which are still on the web. And I was really amazed when the thing was published, how readable it was and what a great job they did with it. And so while I think, and I know that there are some schools that are using it, and private schools, it's a little too partisan, I think, for public schools. And I know that a lot of people are buying them by the case and giving them away to their friends because it is so readable and so accessible. It also has some of the most solid information in it of any of the books that I've written. But anyhow, that's how it happened, Al.
Okay, well, that's very interesting.
Yeah.
I was wondering about the others. Normally, I read heavier material.
Yeah, you want heavier material, pick up on Equal Protection, you know, the rise of corporate dominance and the theft of human rights. That, you know, it's a 260-page you know, really drills down deep into American history, and it's solid and it's well footnoted, or what would Jefferson do? But Unequal Protection is probably the densest of the books I've written. It took about 4 years to write that book. So, you know, by and large, those are the kind of things that I write. But Al, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from you. I appreciate it. The White House has a whiteout problem. A whiteout problem for the White House. Yes, the Bush administration has gotten into the nasty habit of doctoring its reports. I believe this is from the Center for American Progress. Cattle grazing, for example. The Bush administration altered critical portions of a scientific analysis of the environmental impact of cattle grazing on public lands before they announced relaxed grazing limits on those lands, according to left-wing radical, according to scientists involved in the study. Conclusions that the proposed rules might adversely affect water quality and wildlife, including endangered species, were cut out and replaced with language justifying less stringent regulations favored by cattle ranchers. Cattle grazing. They're whiting out the science. They're doing away with the science. We got a faith-based administration here. We don't need no stinking science. Hog farming. Nationally respected Agriculture Department microbiologist Dr. Zahn discovered that hog farms were emitting drug-resistant airborne bacteria that, if breathed by humans, would make them harder to treat when ill. He presented. Now, keep in mind, this guy is working for the government, for the federal government, for the Department of Agriculture. He presented his findings at a scientific conference in 2000, and then the Bushies stepped in. The Bushies, of course, came to power in 2001. And between September 2001 and April of 2002, the Bush administration stopped Dr. Zahn 11 times from publishing his data about the dangers of hog farms. When Danish researchers wanted to learn more about his works, he was not allowed by the Bush administration to share his techniques. Climate change. Now, this one probably most folks are familiar with. The oil industry, you know, had their guy inside the White House, a good old Mr. Philip Cooney, who's now back working for ExxonMobil, and he removed or adjusted descriptions of climate change the government scientists and their supervisors, including some senior Bush administration officials, had already approved. In many cases, the changes appeared in the final reports. What about air quality at Ground Zero? This is after 9/11, the attack on the World Trade Center. The White House instructed the EPA to give the public misleading information. You get this? The EPA, the organization, the institution within government, created, by the way, on Richard Nixon's watch by a Democratic Congress, but signed into law by Richard Nixon. The EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, was instructed by the White House to lie to New Yorkers about when it was safe to breathe the air and what air and where you could safely breathe it. That finding was in a report just released Friday by the Office of the Inspector General of the EPA. Released Friday just in time to miss the news cycle, of course. It noted that some of the agency's news releases in the weeks after the attack were softened before being released to the public. Reassuring information was added while cautionary information was deleted. The White House, faith-based science on the toxicology of mercury. The White House and the Office of Management and Budget, the OMB, made changes to a report from the National Academy of Sciences on the toxic on how dangerous, how toxic mercury is, especially to pregnant women and young children. This was a report that was commissioned by Congress to establish the science on these risks, and the White House went in and downplayed. They altered the report to downplay the risk of mercury, replacing specific listings of mercury-related harms with bland general references and introduced additional emphasis on uncertainty. Condoms. The Federal Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and USAID have removed or revised fact sheets on condoms, removing information about their effectiveness in disease prevention and promoting abstinence instead. Condoms. They're lying to us about condoms. They're lying to us about effects on oil drilling in the Arctic Refuge. Interior Secretary, let's say whiting it out. We don't need science. We have faith in voodoo economics. Interior Secretary Gail Norton substantially altered biological findings from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service concerning the effects of oil development in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge before she gave them to Congress, according to documents released October 19th by Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility. In one instance, Norton's defense was that she simply made an error in her testimony, saying outside when she meant to say inside. Yeah, right. Abortion. The National Cancer Institute had on its website a scientific study that showed that women who get abortions have no added risk of breast cancer. No, none. The White House said, take it down. In response, the National Cancer Institute updated its website to include the conclusion of a panel of experts that induced abortion is not associated with an increase in breast cancer risk. They fought back. One of the few. Cancer. The EPA guidelines acknowledge for the first time that children under the age of 2 are 10 times more likely to get cancer from certain chemicals than adults. The EPA changed the language after the White House Office of Management and Budget got to them. 10 minutes before the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
W, you gotta help me. These mercury emission standards are gonna kill my bottom line. You'll take care of it? How much should I make this out for? Do say hello to your pappy.
We will sing, we will cheer. Millionaires from ashore here. Politicians start making a fuss.
Yes, it's the billionaires for Bush. They're back. Welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman. And you are in the real free speech zone, where you'll receive your minimum daily adult requirement of sanity. We were speaking of the White House's whiteout obsession, going through the list here. Groundwater. This is a big one. This is incredible. Vice President Dick Cheney's old company, Halliburton, pioneered an oil drilling technique that can contaminate drinking water supplies with carcinogens and therefore is required by law to be regulated by the EPA. Halliburton spent years trying to get the federal government to exempt the technique from environmental regulations. A senior Environmental Protection Agency official recently revealed that the EPA initially concluded that the technique can be dangerous to public health, but then deleted that conclusion after Cheney's office demanded it. Further, 6 of the 7 EPA panel members who decided that the technique was safe had all come from, guess what, the energy industry. Surprise, surprise. Stem cell research. The Bush administration dismissed Dr. Elizabeth Blackburn, a leading cell biologist, and Dr. William May, a prominent medical ethicist from the President's Council on Bioethics. Blackburn was removed from the panel soon after she objected to a council report on stem cell research. In an essay in the April 1, 2004 issue of the New England Journal of Medicine, Dr. Blackburn recounted how the dissenting opinion she submitted, which she believes reflects the scientific consensus in America, was not included in the council's reports, even though she had been told the reports would represent the views of all the council members. Yes, we'd love you to be on the council. Please, bring your name, bring your credibility. Oh, you don't agree with us? Out. Out. HIV/AIDS during the latter half of 2002. Speaking of out, the White House, as in whiteout, as in not, the Bush administration began removing scientific information relating to the spread of HIV from government websites, including those of the Department of Health and Human Services, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, and the National Institutes of Health. Much of the information that was removed contradicted claims made by the administration's abstinence-only agenda. It's all about faith-based science. We got no faith in science, so Bush lied, Americans die. And I'm not talking about Iraq. I'm talking about groundwater, about stem cell research, about cancer, about AIDS, about abortion, about mercury, about air quality at ground zero, about climate change, about hog farming, about cattle grazing. Bush lied, and Americans are dying. That's wrong. Get active.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 7 minutes past the hour. When did Condoleezza Rice say that the administration told Americans Iraq would be a generational commitment? Well, I mean, other than this weekend. All right, this weekend on Fox News Sunday, Condi Rice says the Bush administration fairly can be criticized for failing to level with the American people about how long and difficult this commitment will be. She was asked this question. Her response, this is what Condoleezza Rice said. Her response, quote, "The administration, I think, has said to the American people that this is a generational commitment to Iraq." I'm sorry. Ain't so. On March 16th of 2003, Dick Cheney was asked, you know, how long are we, you know, what's it going to be like? He says, "My belief is we will, in fact, be greeted as liberators. I think it will go relatively quickly, in weeks rather than months." Donald Rumsfeld, on February 7th of 2003, "It is unknowable," he said, "how long that conflict will last. It could last 6 days, 6 weeks, I doubt 6 months." Mitch Daniels, the former budget director, February 28th, 03, speaking to the press, "The United States is committed to helping Iraq recover from the conflict, but Iraq will not require sustained aid." Excuse me, he was speaking to Congress. As Think Progress notes, "You may think that the Bush administration's strategy is the Middle East, including the war in Iraq, and that it isn't going so well." Well, Condi Rice offered a different perspective. Not only, she says, is the administration's policy successful, but it's the only administration that has been successful in the last six decades. She says, "For 60 years, my country, the United States, pursued stability at the expense of democracy in this region here in the Middle East, and we achieved neither. Now we are taking a different course." Right. "We are now making the Middle East more stable. Hadn't you noticed? With the invasion of Iraq, far more stable." Yes, absolutely. And not only that, Rice was employed by Reagan and Bush 1, Bush Sr., and she just took a slap at him. The Reagan administration was not pursuing democracy in the Middle East. The Bush administration, the Bush senior administration was not pursuing democracy in the Middle East. Only Bush Jr. And then on top of that, we get George Bush in his radio address this weekend. "We went to war because we were attacked, and we are at war today because there are still people out there who want to harm our country and hurt our citizens, hoping desperately that people across America listening will think that Saddam Hussein and Iraq had something to do with 9-11. Those must have been Iraqis in those airplanes on 9-11. And truth be told, more than half of all people who voted for Republicans in the last election believe that there were Iraqis in the planes that hit the towers. And for those of you who are listening who still hold to that belief, there were none. Iraq had nothing to do with it. Iraq and Osama bin Laden, Saddam Hussein and Osama bin Laden hated each other. Bush then went on to say, "All of us can agree that the world's terrorists have now made Iraq a central front in the war on terror." Excuse me. "We have made Iraq a central front in the war on terror." Then Bush goes on to say, "Our troops are fighting these terrorists in Iraq, so you will not have to face them here at home." Carefully, a sentence carefully tested by Frank Luntz. I'm telling you, they tried this thing out on a lot of people, and this one really moved the people meter. It's wrong, but it moved the people meter. And you can expect over the course of the next couple of weeks, in particular in the build-up to July 4th, in the week before July 4th, next week, over the next week and a half or so, expect George W. Bush Jr. here, to be coming out with a series of statements conflating 9/11, as mixing together 9/11 and the attack on Iraq. For example, this is just an example of how he does it. This is what he said when he declared that the war in Iraq was over. He was on the aircraft carrier of the USS Abraham Lincoln, you know, was flown in, was chauffeured in by an actual real pilot. Well, Bush is an actual real pilot. He just, you know, went AWOL during war. Nonetheless, he was flown in and, you know, strutting around with his flight suit on. And then he goes and he says,
"My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed."
Everybody gets all excited. Now comes the kind of rhetoric that you can expect to hear more of over the next 2 weeks in particular.
"The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
Oh, really?
And still goes on.
Yeah, I'll say that.
That terrible morning, 19 evil men, the shock troops of a hateful ideology.
15 of them from Saudi Arabia.
Civilized world, a glimpse of their ambitions.
The country that has given $1 billion to your family and your business partners.
That September the 11th would be the beginning of the end of America. By seeking to turn our cities into killing fields, terrorists and their allies believed they could destroy this nation's resolve."
You get that, how smoothly he moved from the battle for Baghdad to 9/11 and back to the battle for Baghdad, as if it was all one thing. Oh, yes, Baghdad. It must have something to do with 9/11. It's got nothing to do with 9/11. Nothing to do with 9/11. And he continues,
"Enforce our retreat from the world."
No. It's Yes, they were trying to force our retreat from Saudi Arabia, actually. Osama bin Laden came out and back in the mid-90s and said, if you don't pull your troops, in 91, Bush Sr. put American troops on the ground in Saudi Arabia as a staging ground for the Gulf War, for the first Gulf War against Saddam Hussein when we kicked him out of Kuwait. And Osama bin Laden said, this is wrong, this is blasphemous, that you would have American men who are smoking and drinking alcohol and American women who are driving automobiles and not wearing scarves over their heads and have the right to vote in their country. It is blasphemous that you would have them on Saudi soil. And if you don't pull them out, then Osama said he was going to attack the United States. And sure enough, he did. And by the way, Bush Jr., pulled them out. We have since pulled them out. Anyhow, he continues.
"They have failed."
Yeah, they have failed. No, we actually pulled them out. So, who failed? Interesting question. Which side? How did it go? Which one won? Everybody loves this rhetoric from George Jr. They just absolutely love this rhetoric from George Jr. The applause just goes on and on and on, and he's just standing there just loving it. Unfortunately, it's not true. There's no relationship between 9/11 and Iraq. You know, Dick Cheney was out there trying to draw this tortuous, you know, oh, maybe we can pull this piece of string through this keyhole. You know, about, there were Mohammed Atta was meeting in Czechoslovakia and Prague with somebody from the Iraqi intelligence service. As if that meant anything, even if it happened. But then we find out that it never happened. It never happened. The next thing they're going to pull out of the hat, which apparently did happen, was that some of these hijackers went through Iran on their way out of the Middle East. Does that mean the Iranian government had anything to do with 9/11? Who knows? But you can bet that they're gonna trot that one out. It's like any excuse to start a war. This guy is war obsessed. Any excuse to start a war. And in fact, according to Scott Ritter, the war with Iran has already begun. Ritter says the reality is that the U.S. war with Iran, as we speak, has already begun. American overflights of Iranian soil are taking place using pilotless drones and other more sophisticated capabilities. The violation of a sovereign nation's airspace is an act of war in and of itself. He says this has gone way beyond intelligence gathering. Bush, taking advantage of the sweeping powers granted to him after 9/11, is initiating covert offensive operations inside Iran. Now here's where it gets really interesting. Inside Iran, there is a group called the Mujahideen El-Khalq, or MEK. It's an operation, it's an opposition group, an Iranian opposition group that was set up and run by Saddam Hussein's intelligence service. Now you get this? Iran and Iraq have been enemies for years. They had these incredible wars, all these battles, Iran and Iraq. And so Iraq, Saddam Hussein, fighting the Iranians. I lost 1 million people in that war. A lot of people died. Saddam Hussein, in his war with Iraq, with Iran rather, Iraq's war with Iran, Saddam Hussein puts spies into Iran. Well, of course he would. And, you know, it's his intelligence service. And it's a phony opposition group. Or it's a real opposition. I mean, they're really opposed to the Iranians. But they were opposed to the Iranians on behalf of Saddam. In fact, we still label them as a terrorist organization. MEK. But now that Saddam is gone, we've taken it over. And so we're now running the terrorist organization in Iran that is being used to terrorize Iranians, including terror bombings inside Iran. But that's not the only one. Scott Ritter says to the north and neighboring Azerbaijan, the U.S. military is preparing a base of operations for a massive military presence that will foretell a major land-based campaign designed to capture Tehran. See, we did this the same thing we did in 2001, early 2002. In preparation for the invasion of Iraq, we started building our bases out in Qatar and expanding the bases in Kuwait and so forth. Same thing happening now in Azerbaijan. Secretary of Defense Don Rumsfeld's interest in Azerbaijan may have escaped the blinkered Western media, but Russia and the Caucasus nations understand only too well that the die has been cast regarding Azerbaijan's role in the upcoming war with Iran, writes Scott Ritter. The ethnic links between the Azeri of northern Iran and Azerbaijan were long exploited by the Soviet Union during the Cold War. In other words, we're hooking up with the countries around Iran to prepare for the invasion of Iran. In fact, U.S. air power, he says, should be able to maintain a nearly 24-hour-a-day presence over Tehran airspace once military hostilities commence. U.S. Marine Corps will be able to secure these towns in order to protect the vital Straits of Hormuz, and the need to advance inland has been eliminated. Right through the Caspian Sea into Tehran. 20 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
It ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe. It don't matter anyhow. And it ain't no use to sit and wonder why, babe.
Well, I can tell you why. I can tell you why he invaded Iraq. He did it so the Republicans could take power. It's that simple. It was a power grab, pure and simple. He wanted to be a war president. He told his biographer about it in 1999, that when he had a chance to invade Iraq, he wouldn't squander the political capital the way his daddy did. He would get his programs passed. He would end Social Security. He would take care of those miserable people who wanted socialism, like the minimum wage and unemployment insurance. And he would get rid of that. Now, Plessy versus Ferguson is being used to justify violating the Geneva Convention. This is a new one. Plessy versus Ferguson, of course, the Supreme Court case that codified, legalized, put into law segregation in the United States, 1896, Plessy versus Ferguson. Good old Mr. Ferguson, as I recall. I believe that it was Ferguson who was the slave. I could be wrong. I might have it the other way around. Anyhow, one of them hopped up on a got on a train, went into the whites-only compartment. He was an African-American, the son of a freed slave. And, in fact, he was arrested by the other. Now, as I recall, Ferguson was the cop. Ferguson arrested Plessy and said, nope, you got to get off, threw him off the train. Plus, he gets back on, he gets arrested again. He gets back on, he gets thrown off. He gets back on, he gets arrested again. This time they take him off. And he takes a case all the way to the Supreme Court. Now, this was actually part of a large civil rights effort to get this case before the Supreme Court in the hope of ending apartheid in the United States. And what it did was, you know, the Plessy versus Ferguson hearing was the case where the Supreme Court said that you know, the races, you can legally enforce laws that prevent the mixing of races, that legally establish segregation. So here's Dianne Feinstein, and she's questioning General Thomas Huntington. Dianne Feinstein, the senator from California. She's questioning this general. She says, 7 months in solitary confinement, doesn't that violate the Geneva Convention? She's talking about, you know, one of our enemy combatants, one of our prisoners of war. He says, I wouldn't call his condition solitary. She says, would you call it isolation? He says, I would call it segregation. Right, there you go. It's just segregation. That's all we're doing. The room was aghast when this little rhetorical struggle ensued between Huntington and Pat Leahy. Pat Leahy, how many detainees are there at Guantanamo Bay? Huntington, that's outside the scope of my responsibility. I'd suggest you ask the Secretary of Defense. Ah, yes, our open book source, Secretary Rumsfeld. Leahy, are there any detainees from countries other than Afghanistan? Huntington, that's outside the scope of my responsibility, as said the general. Yeah, just 2 minutes earlier. This is from Campus Progress, by the way. Just 2 minutes earlier, when defending the decision not to return detainees to Afghanistan for trial, Huntington responded, but we have 47 different countries represented at Guantanamo Bay. Yeah. Definitely no Cuban cigar. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Alice in Humboldt County on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
I've got two messages.
Okay.
Convalescent Rice recently told troops in Iraq that they should remember that they brought this war to us, not us to them. That's the first one.
You're right. And Condoleezza Rice also part of the lie machine to make people think that, that Saddam and Iraq had something to do with 9/11 when they didn't. Good point.
And the other one is, do you think that John Kerry and Edwards or Hillary or any of our Democratic senators or congressmen have figured out how badly the Republicans have been stealing elections?
I think it's starting to dawn on them, frankly, Alice. I really do. I think that John Kerry probably has figured it out, just like Al Gore clearly figured it out after the fact. The problem is that they also know that the media is such, and the atmosphere in this country is such, there's such right-wing control over the media, and there's such a huge right-wing echo chamber, that if they try to say anything, they're going to be portrayed as conspiracy theory nuts. It's the Governor Romney problem. Governor Romney of Michigan, I was living in Michigan as a little kid when this happened, or a teenager. Romney went over to Vietnam, and he came back and he said that he had been brainwashed by the U.S. military, and this guy was a Republican, by the way. But he had come out against the war, and they ripped him apart in the media that he never recovered. It was the end of his political career. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back, my friends. This is why, I'm telling you, this is why George W. Bush made the comment to his biographer, the fellow he had initially hired as his biographer, that a leader, a true leader, never admits a mistake. that he always looks forward, he never looks back, and he never admits a mistake. And you can see that Bush really believes that that's what a true leader does. He's wrong, but he believes it. And the reality is that American politics is not particularly forgiving of mistakes, or of people, excuse me, is very forgiving of mistakes, but not forgiving of people who confess to them. George Romney, in 1967, on September 4th, 1967, he was having a conversation in Detroit with a television news guy, Lou Gordon. And he was talking about how he had taken a tour of Southeast Asia in 1965. Now, keep in mind, this was relatively early in the Vietnam War. He had taken a tour in 65, and the generals had been trying to convince him of, you know, how important the Vietnam War was and all the, you know, quack, quack, quack. And he said it was like, you know, they were trying to brainwash me. He said I was brainwashed by them. I thought that the war was a good thing. He was explaining how and why in 65 he had been in favor of the war, and by 67 he had changed his mind and he was opposed to it. And he just used the word casually. I mean, it was just, you know, it was an offhand comment in a conversation with a TV reporter. And that, and Romney was, you know, he represented a serious threat to Barry Goldwater in 68 to run for president. I mean, the leading contenders were Goldwater, Rockefeller, and Romney, representing the extreme right, the extreme left, and the middle of the Republican Party at that time. And George Romney, he was toast. I mean, they ate him alive. Oh, he was brainwashed. Oh, he must have been some kind of idiot. Oh, he was so naive. How could anybody be brainwashed? Come on, do we want a president who can be brainwashed? You don't want anybody. And on it went. And that's why, to this day, you will not hear Al Gore say, you know, looking back on it, I shouldn't have stopped fighting to have every vote counted in Florida. When, in fact, he knows that it's true. Had every vote been counted, he would have won. And that's why you will not hear John Kerry saying, you know, we really should have an investigation of what happened in Ohio. Because these guys don't want to be Romneyized. They get it. That in American politics, pretty much your only choice is to keep moving. Now, there's a lot of us who will continue to point out what's happened in the past, but in their world, you just keep moving. You got to keep moving ahead. TomHartmann.com, our website. If you want to drop in and say hi, click on the live chat button. It'll drop you into the live chat room where you will find some of the most thoughtful, entertaining, insightful, interesting, powerful, pondering, intelligent, intellectual, and occasionally outrageous conversations on the entire Internet. And, of course, if you want to call into the program, our number 1-866-889-8894. Elaine in Northern California on the line. Hey, Elaine, welcome to the program.
Good morning, Tom. I don't think that Junior and his administration ever intend to leave Iraq in that area. Last night I heard on KGO Bernie Ward's program, San Francisco, that they are in the process of building 17 U.S. bases.
Major
in
bases.
Iraq.
Major bases,
major.
Yes.
Major.
Yeah,
yes.
We're talking. Huge, huge military bases. They're going to spend $1 billion on the embassy there. That's more than they're estimating it will cost to rebuild the World Trade Center.
And about a year and a half ago, I happened to be ill and sitting and watching the TV, and he was on. And he made the remark that he was going to rebuild Babylon, and that would be the major center for the world, for the New World Order.
Whoa.
So
George Bush Jr. said, George W. Bush said that?
He said that. I saw it and heard it with my own ears.
Wow. Do you happen to know the date that he said it?
I sure don't. I wish I could remember.
Was it in a news conference or a speech or what?
I think it was a news conference, but I'm not sure. It was about a year and a half ago.
Well, I'm guessing that the folks in our chat room will be able to track that one down. That's a quote I'd love to have.
I have not found anyone that I've told it to that has heard it. Of course, it was about 10 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, well,
West Coast time.
And when Bush misspeaks or says stupid things, the press just ignores it.
So
you know?
he's just trying to build up his empire over there.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's the New World Order.
Yeah, I heard something else on Bernie Ward's show last night that troubled me. If a military man is injured on the ground, if he is picked up by helicopter and he dies while in the air,
he's not counted.
Well, there is some debate about that. That may or may not be the case. There are a lot of people who are suggesting that that's the case. On the other hand, if you look at some of the casualty reports coming back, many of those casualty reports indicate that people died who are listed as died, in, you know, killed in the Iraq conflict, died in places like the hospital in Germany.
Right.
So, you know, it's in fact, I saw one just last week, which is causing me to think that either the Department of Defense has changed the way that they do their accounting recently, or there's a conspiracy theory here that doesn't have a basis. And here's what causes me to think that maybe it's a conspiracy theory without a basis. And I'm not completely there, but here's why I think that. When I was doing this program before from Vermont, we live in Portland, Oregon now, but for the first 2 years of this program, I was broadcasting live from downtown Montpelier, Vermont. And Vermont is a small state. There's only 600,000 people in Vermont. And we had had, about the time I left Vermont, this was, you know, a couple months ago, as I recall, we had had either 7 or 9 people die in the Vietnam, in the Iraq War, or the Iraq invasion and occupation. Now, that doesn't sound like a lot of people, but for a little state with only 600,000 people in, I mean, that's fewer people than lived in the county that I lived in Georgia, in Cobb County, Georgia, when Newt Gingrich was my congressman back in the 80s. I mean, so, you know, the whole state of Vermont's bigger than some counties in a lot of states. And everybody, you know, the newspaper, whenever somebody died, they would make a big deal about it. And they would report the name of the person that died. And very often those stories would also report the names of the other 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 people who had died before that person. And I just have to believe that if anybody from Vermont had died as a result of the Iraqi conflict and not been reported, that their family would have stood up and said something, and that it would have made it into the media, because Vermont's a very progressive state, and there's a lot of alternative media there, and you just can't hide those things in a small state like Vermont. So either the Department of Defense is so sophisticated that they're able to bury some of these deaths in New York and California statistics or something like that, or it's not happening. I just don't know. You know, as I said, This is something that a lot of people are raising, and I know there are several websites devoted to it. I spent a lot of time on one last night, in fact, you know, just looking for some documentation. Please give me a list of names. You know, give me some credible information that makes this real. I would love to see it. I have not seen it so far, and I have a feeling that that's one of the reasons why this has not been a mainstream story. Thank you so much for the call, by the way. An MP is suing the Pentagon, a U.S. military policeman who was beaten by fellow MPs during a botched training drill at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba prison. Well, they call it prison. I call it a concentration camp for detainees. Has sued the Pentagon for $15 million, saying the incident violated his constitutional rights. This is Specialist Sean Baker. He's 38. He volunteered to wear an orange jumpsuit and portray an uncooperative detainee. And they beat him. They beat him so bad that he has permanent traumatic brain injury. The guy's a Persian Gulf War vet who re-enlisted after 9/11. He said the assault left him with seizures, blackout, headaches, insomnia, and psychological problems. Now, this is the guy who is on our side, and the soldiers knew it. And they were just practicing on what they do to detainees. You have to wonder, you know, what's going on in that concentration camp down there? Or those concentration camps, actually. There's 5 of them. We're building a 6th right now. At the cost of hundreds of millions of dollars. And who's the contractor? Halliburton. Yes. And now Bill Clinton has come out and said, enough with Guantanamo Bay already. In an interview with the Financial Times, this from the Financial Times itself, the former president called for the camp set up to hold suspected terrorists to be, quote, closed down or cleaned up, end quote. The Financial Times notes Mr. Clinton joined critics at home and abroad who have singled out the indefinite detention of prisoners without trial and widespread reports of human rights violations of Guantanamo. He said it's time that there are no more stories coming out there about people being abused. Mr. Clinton said the test for judging whether harsh treatment of terrorist suspects was justified was whether it challenged the fundamental nature of American society. He said if the answer is yes, you've already given the terrorists a profound victory. They have turned you, that's the end of quote from Bill Clinton. And I would say, If the answer is yes, if our treatment of prisoners in Guantanamo, in the Guantanamo Bay concentration camps, or in the prisons in Iraq, for that matter, or in Afghanistan, if our treatment of those prisoners is fundamentally at odds with the values that we hold as an American society, then Osama bin Laden has already won. He has turned the Bush administration into him. I'm not willing to say he's turned America into him, because the majority of us do not agree with this, with that kind of behavior. The majority of Americans get it, that the way to win a war on terror is to be a great moral force in the world. And the way you get to be a great moral force in the world is to lead by example. But George W. Bush, in his entire lifetime, has never led by example. In fact, he's spent most of his life being ashamed of his example and embarrassed by his example, as was most of his family, the black sheep of the family. He cleaned up his act. I salute him for that. But the reality is that, you know, leading by example's not been real high on his list. I think he really doesn't get it. I really do. I think he doesn't get it. Tom in Eureka, California has some thoughts on this. Hey, Tom, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Tom. First, I just wanted to say you make my mornings very pleasant.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
And thanks for listening on, what is it, KGOE there in Eureka?
Exactly. Yeah, and I love hearing Alice, who I don't know who she is, but she lives somewhere up here near me calling every morning.
Yes, she's marvelous.
Yeah, yeah. I read that story that you were just talking about the MP who was beaten and now has the seizures and everything. Mm-hmm. But the version that I read stated that he was, the people who beat him did not know that he was an American.
Halfway through the beating, he had words to yell out, where, you know, saying, "Hey, you know, this is me," or whatever. Yes, you're right. When it first started, they did not know. Halfway into it, they figured it out.
And the story that I read said that the people who beat him were told that, I can't remember what it was he had supposedly done, but he had like done something that they considered bad to a fellow guard, and that's what started the savage beating.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't seen that.
That part of it. If you have a minute,
but that still doesn't justify.
Absolutely.
You know, although that is, I mean, this is prison justice. Unfortunately, tragically, this is the sort of thing. You know, somebody goes to jail for killing a cop, and they're toast in that jail. You know,
yeah.
Committed an offense against guards in a prison as a prisoner, you know, life can get pretty miserable.
Yeah. If you have a minute, I have one other quick question.
Sure.
A little while ago, back when, remember the weekend where the story came out that John Kerry was going to bring up the Downing Street memo on the floor of the Senate?
Yes. And now there was an op-ed in I believe it was one of the Boston papers yesterday, saying that Kerry has decided to lie low on this.
Yeah, because that,
lay low.
The Monday after that weekend, when you were discussing it, I called his office on that SOB number that is so hilarious.
1-877-SOB-USOB, the toll-free number for Congress. Yep.
And and what one of his aides was telling me was that they basically were backpedaling. You know, they were trying to say, "Oh, the story was exaggerated," et cetera, et cetera.
I see.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And
we'll see. You know, it's I guess we've already seen. Kerry has not come out and said anything about it.
Yeah, you know, I think I'm going to use that SOB number again because I was reading the story last night. I was reading a column last night about there's 15 senators who wouldn't sign on to the apologizing for the lynchings.
Right.
I think I'm going to call their offices and ask why they would not sign
start
on.
Yes, start with the Texas delegation. Call Kay Bailey Hutchinson and ask her, you know, why she didn't. It was all Republicans, by the way. All of them. You know.
After I make those calls, I'll let you know what kind of responses I get.
Okay, great. Tom, thanks a lot. Good to hear from you. I appreciate your calling in. Chuck Hagel. Is Chuck Hagel, the Republican, the former chairman, the former president, you know, brought out, he worked for George Bush Sr. He was brought from Washington, D.C. to Nebraska to become president of the voting machine company that is now ES&S, one of the largest voting machine companies in the United States. And then he ran for the Senate when he had sold the state of Nebraska his own machines, and so his vote was counted on his machines, scored a stunning upset victory against an incumbent Democratic governor that everybody expected to win. And he's been a good Republican ever since. And now Ken Tomlinson, the head of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Who are these biased liberals that Bill Moyers is letting on his program? According to Tomlinson's study, Senator Chuck Hagel, Republican of Nebraska, is one of them. In the raw data from Tomlinson's study, Hagel was classified as a liberal for an appearance on a segment of a show that questioned the Bush administration's policies in Iraq. Yeah, this is how they figure out. This is Ken Tomlinson sitting around, the chairman of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, sitting around with a bunch of his buddies at the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, going, "We got to make this more balanced here. We got to get these liberals off the air." Well, who are the liberals, Ken? Well, there's that Chuck Hagel guy. He's too liberal. Yeah. Well, you know, reality is Hagel is trying to position himself for a run for president in 2008 as a centrist Republican, but plan on it. He'll be probably on the ticket as vice president, if not president. After all, I mean, he knows how to run voting machines. 10 minutes before the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
And who's going to be the one to say it was no good what we done? I dare a man to say I'm too young, for I'm going to try for the sun.
And welcome back, my friends. 4.5 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. In the Boy, Isn't That Weird department, Jessica Lynch, you know, has selective memory, I guess is what they call it. Here, you know, her and the people with her exposed to depleted uranium. She was in a car accident, a traumatic event, and she doesn't have a clear memory of exactly what happened. She does know that she didn't empty her weapon, and you know that whole story that the Pentagon made up, just like the whole story, the Pat Tillman story that the Pentagon made up, that none of that was true. But she doesn't really know what happened. And now we're discovering that the people who do know what happened, strange things are happening. Petty Officer First Class David M. Tapper, he was one of the folks who helped rescue her, one of her rescuers and colleagues. He recently died in Afghanistan. Lance Corporal Sukhang Ong. He was part of the rescue team. He was just killed in a drive-by shooting. Specialist Josh Daniel Spear, part of the rescue team. He died when his car crashed into some trees for no apparent reason. And Kyle Edward Williams, who worked in the same company as Lynch, recently died of suicide. No, I frankly think that this is just a coincidence. No, I really and seriously do. But I can guarantee you there's going to be a few people out there going, hey, wait a minute, no way is that a coincidence. Now, what concerns me more, and this is no coincidence, is that the Bush administration now is shopping around the idea, quietly they say, quietly shopping around the idea, of requiring internet service providers to make logs and keep logs of everything that passes through them on the part of their customers, so that web browsing, chat room activity, email, the websites you visit, the news groups you read, the files you download, everything will be logged by your ISP, your internet service provider, and those logs will by law be kept for years and can be inspected any old time by the Department of Homeland Security. Coming up next, these are called data detention rules. Scary stuff. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program. Thanks for being with us today. Thanks to Scott for being here answering the phones, Louise for producing the show, and we will see you tomorrow. Keep up the good work. Don't forget, call your member of Congress, your United States Senator or your member of Congress, 1-877-SOB-USOB. SOB, the letter U, SOB. Call them up and pick an issue. Every day, give him a shout. Talk to you later.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.